Hello everyone and welcome to this week's Big Boat Interview. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and this week I sat down with Bob Dennison, President and Founder of Dennison Yachting. I hope you enjoy our conversation. We talked about everything really, from colourful chinos to NFTs. And with that, I hope you enjoy. Bob, thank you for taking part in the Boat Briefing podcast. I just wanted to start off, actually, because we were mentioning just before we started recording about your asking prices, and we started off talking about the price of French bulldogs and then got onto yachts. But I was wondering, in comparing now to traditional periods of brokerage transactions, what kind of discounting are you seeing on brokerage boats now? Is there any, or asking prices, are they being defended? So, you know, what's your experience of that?
Yeah, for the first time in my life doing this, and I guess I've been doing it pretty much my whole adult life, it's a bizarre world of very little discounting happening, especially here in the US. The American buyer, and with all categories of boats, big and small, power and sail, there's this like condition of getting really aggressive with offers that you make. Right now, we're seeing some of those same buyers making some of the same kind of aggressive offers, and those offers aren't even being countered now. So we're seeing a different set of buyers come in that are probably, certain are aware that they are likely overpaying compared to what would have been perceived as normal a few years ago. And they are okay with it because they see that we yacht brokers call it like an investment in your family and experiences and all that stuff. And they're very soberly buying a yacht at a price that would have been a little bit more a few years ago, but they're okay with it because they just want to get out in the water and spend time with their family.
But does that mean that owners are very aware of the activity in the market, and are they coming to you and, you know, saying, putting silly asking prices on their boats? Do you have to talk them down?
Yep, there's definitely a few of those. And it just, in any market, there's always going to be certain owners that are going to want to just test the market and see if they can get more than they ever dreamed. And that is happening on occasion. We actually have one owner that set his asking price higher than we recommended, higher than even he paid for the boat a year ago, much, much higher. And he got an offer that we were all extremely happy with, very excited about. And even at that number, he actually declined the offer because he wasn't able to find another boat to put he and his family into. So it's this weird thing happening where you have owners like that are testing the market, getting really high offers, and on occasion not even accepting those high offers because they don't have the ability to get into a different boat once that one sells.
Is that an awkward conversation often? I mean, how do you know if you're dealing with a guy worth 500 million or 5 billion, and they're saying I want X for my boat, and you're saying, well, I'm afraid that's just not realistic. I mean, how do you even approach that conversation?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most underappreciated skills of a really, really good yacht broker, is handling awkward conversations without making them obviously awkward. And the very best of the best do that effectively. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely can enter into some uncomfortable territory. And our job as a broker is to facilitate a transaction and make, in the best way that we can, the buyer and the seller happy. And again, these conversations we're having are different, but they're still sort of part of conversations we were having years ago, just sort of with a different flavor.
Talking about years ago, I mean, you've been in the business, almost since birth. I mean, is it, have you ever known a time like this before?
No, definitely not. I think we all experienced something that kind of smelled and tasted and looked like this back in 06, 07. And I certainly hope it's going to have a different conclusion. But it feels like that. I would say the big difference is we have a lot less buyers that are leveraging and buying things they can't afford. There's just a lot of cash out there, and just a much much bigger spike in demand that I think has a lot less to do with new wealth being created, although I think that's part of it. But I think it's more of buyers that were kind of on the fence before, and as a result of COVID and being aware of their own mortality and just having conversations with their family about, let's not wait another 5 years. Let's not wait to do this really cool thing that we want to do. Let's just go out and do it. I think that's really been one of the biggest factors, not only in our industry, but any industry attached to buying and selling things that are really awesome and fun to do.
Yeah, there's definitely a case of, you know, if not now, when?
I feel like somebody needs to name that. I don't know what that's called. I keep describing it and it takes me three sentences to do so, but that could be the thing, Stuart. You may have come up with the definition, the if not now, then when.
Or it's a FOMO market, isn't it?
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. So, but it's been great. And we've along with a lot of other firms had a really, really great few years here.
You really have. And actually, I mean, we see the stats and Denison, you know, you guys have had just a phenomenal 18 months. And what I've noticed, particularly with Denison, is it a deliberate strategy to start engaging with much larger yachts, because you've been selling much bigger boats than is perhaps traditional for the brand in previous years. And so was that something you set out to do at the beginning of this period?
No, it's been building. Our success in the big boat market has been consistently building for 10 to 15 years. And when we have a year like we did last year, I think sometimes you can look on it, it looks like a sort of a instant or overnight success kind of a thing, but we've been tracking about 25-30% increases year over year for the last decade or so. And part of the success of that is that we benefit from taking really, really great care of clients through the entire journey of a yacht or boat buying process. So we have a lot of buyers that bought really big boats last year that started with us 10 years ago on an Azimut or a Sea Ray. If you take awesome care of those people, they're more than likely to stick with you through as they get into bigger boats.
And I suppose that's a great strength of the business as well, isn't it? Because you have the kind of the bedrock of this, you know, you transact on a grand scale in the smaller boat market, but now you've pegged on this, the bigger boats to it as well. So if there's fluctuations in the bigger boat market, I suppose there's always that bedrock, you know, to keep the company vibrant and alive.
Yeah, for sure. And for us, it's you know, it's actually just as much of a challenge, especially as we go to battle in the world of you know, gaining a listing in the super yacht world, as we're competing against some of the best firms in the world. One of the hard things for us, the challenges to overcome, is a big yacht firm saying, "Do you really want to work with those guys? They're also selling Azimuts. They're also selling Sea Rays," or whatever the brand might be. I wouldn't call it an identity crisis, but it definitely is a challenge for our brand. It's definitely something that we try to figure out. As you know, we brought on board Ben Farnborough a few years ago, and he's done a really good job, not just helping us think through that, but also assembling a team on the super yacht services side, from yacht management, crew placement, wholesale charter, retail charter, that we're able to really give a client a family office, give a really good set of services throughout the super yacht journey, which I think has been really, really helpful. When you attach technology to that, when you attach a very disciplined, we're going to do whatever we can to take great care of clients, the rest sort of takes care of itself.
Do you think that after sales, that care, that the attention on after sales care is something that's been lacking in the super yacht space?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's so many, and that's why I'm so excited about our industry. It's not just the short-term kind of bump of demand and all this just these amazing things that are happening, but it's the long-term kind of, how do we figure out creatively with really good people how to make the ownership process easier, more fun, and transparent. And we're certainly not the only ones doing that, but it gets me excited with the industry as a whole, as you have some of these leading bigger firms having those conversations. And I think it is more than likely that as an industry, we're going to do a better job retaining clients that we otherwise would have lost by using technology to have a good ownership experience. And that's not just with things like operating budgets and transparency on where money is being spent, but it's also things like using technology to communicate the selling process. So one of the things that we do, we have an ownership dashboard. So an owner on his time or a captain or a family office can gain visibility on all the things that we're doing to market their yacht.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that all that kind of the transparency is obviously incredibly important because it has been traditionally a fairly opaque thing, owning a super yacht. You know, where's the money going? It's not always easy to tell. So, you know, to have that, you know, complete clear vision is very important and surely will reassure a lot of newcomers to the market, certainly.
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the themes of this decade in yacht ownership is going to be transparency. And it's not just because it's now more possible because of technology, but it's really because it should have been this way the whole time. And technology is going to make it a little bit easier, but accountability measures, just all those things that a yacht or what may have kept a yacht owner on the sidelines before or gotten him out, I think we're going to be able to overcome. And I think you'll see the best firms making yacht ownership much more open, honest, transparent. And there's a lot less questions about where money is spent and why.
Yeah. And you obviously lived through 07, 08 and the aftermath as well, as did I in this industry. And so whenever times get really good, I get nervous, naturally nervous, because I think, you know, what's the other side of this going to look like and feel like for us in the media or for the wider industry or whatever it is. And so do you also have that kind of slightly, nervy?
My wife calls it, she's much more polite about it. She says I have a healthy form of paranoia, but I'm definitely an unsettled entrepreneur or whatever the heck you want to call me. I do sense that also. And we are, even now, just making moves to make sure that we're really well prepared, not if a downturn happens, but when. And we all hope it'll be a softer land than the one we experienced in 07, 08. I think any responsible head of a company or an owner of a company is really sober and thoughtful about those things, because it's history will repeat itself. As awesome as things are now, they will definitely come to an end, or at least a slowdown. And we just need to be prepared for that.
And I hope it's a soft landing, because my fears is if it's a hard landing, we're going to see a glut of boats suddenly coming on the market, which will really dampen prices. And then no one's happy, are they? Owners aren't happy. People staying in their boats aren't happy. I hopefully we can avoid that particular iceberg.
I think so. I really believe our industry, for all the things that we're talking about, it will be better positioned than something like an 07 type of an event. And I also think we'll benefit from the fact that a lot of these families that have entered into yachting that weren't there before, on some level, will stay in. There will certainly be an amount that will leave. But I think this demand, this rise in the tide of demand that we see, will remain much higher than it was before. I just couldn't imagine a world where all of those new owners are going to go back, regardless of economic conditions.
And just on those new owners, I mean, are you able to say there's a certain demographic or there's a certain type of new person coming into the industry, or is it a kind of a broad church, or, you know, is it tech money? Is it where is it coming from?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, here in America, and just in the last 10 days, I've had two dinners with two couples that are brand new into yachting, both bought very significant size boats for the first time, not even coming out of like a production, nothing from zero to 30, 40 meters plus. And both of them were very American. And I use that in the kindest, most like enthusiastic, very passionate about this new adventure they're going to go on. And both of them were less of new wealth events and something like they invented a new tech platform, and were both hardworking, very much had their eyes on doing something like this one day. And the pandemic accelerated their decision to get in now. So that's why in the beginning of this conversation, I referenced that. But one was in retail. The other was in actually science. And they represent, I think, part of this new ownership demographic that's going to stick around no matter what.
So a lot of it, a lot of this new activity can be accounted for by people who have been sitting on the fence previously. So there's lots of people kind of maybe we'll get into it one day. So all those people have just been pushed off the fence, basically.
Yeah, I would say that there's been a really decent number, not only here in the US, but also in Europe. And of course, there's going to be a certain percentage that are going to jump back over and they're going to say, this was too crazy for me. I don't ever want to do it again. Or maybe I'll just go back to chartering. But I really believe a healthier portion of that population is going to stick around.
Yeah. And it's a deeply unfair question to ask you, but it's the one kind of everyone wants to know. I mean, what is the time horizon on the current market? I mean, are we talking 6, 12, 18 months? I mean, it's impossible to forecast, I guess.
Yeah, I'm really bad at that. So I've actually predicted that every 6 months I have a conversation with our family and friends about that exact topic. And every single time I say, next few quarters, we're going to start experiencing this dip. And every single time I've been wrong. That, again, might be attached to my healthy form of paranoia or half glass empty sort of thing that happens to me. But I mean, at some point very soon, we're going to have to see a little bit of a softening. Again, this is being recorded, so I might look back on this and sound like a real idiot. But I think this summer and fall, we'll start to experience a little bit more normality in the market, less of a catastrophic fall and more of a, this sounds and looks more normal than it used to, sort of a feeling.
Yeah, but even the new normal might be at an elevated level to what the previous normal was, given there's so many more owners in the pool now, I suppose.
Let's hope so, yeah.
Yeah, and the charter market, meanwhile, is keeping everyone very, very busy. I mean, it's going to be a huge med season. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, for sure. That's actually one of the reasons that we planted a flag in Monaco this year, was to anticipate a stronger demand for chartering in the med, especially by our American clientele. I think one of the reasons we benefited so much in the last few years is because of some of the lockdowns that occurred in the med on the charter front. We really saw huge, huge spikes in demand for our US-based fleet. And I think all those, not only American, but some European charters that came here, the Bahamas, the Caribbean, the US to charter for a few years, they are just chomping at the bit to have a great week in the med. And anybody you talk to in our business is talking about all the weeks that they've already booked. So I think it's going to be one of those incredible seasons in the med that that'll be historic in nature.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's interesting, actually. And how was the Caribbean season for you guys, charter-wise? The one that's on now.
Incredible. It was awesome. It was really great. I think on the kind of behind-the-scenes industry side of things, it was a little weird having two charter shows happen at the same time. I don't know how well that played out. But in terms of actual booking of weeks, it was phenomenal. I mean, we saw a 65% uptick in bookings, and that's not like a made-up number that I'm just saying to sound cool or sound successful. Those are real numbers, and we're not the only ones. There's just massive amounts of people that wanted to go to the Caribbean, St. Martin, St. Barts, and it was just so easy to get there too. And with the different waves of pandemic, or you know, the new Omicron, like, it's harder and harder to go overseas or predict what's going to happen next month. But when you're an American, it's easier to predict that little flight to St. Martin than it is to Nice. So, yeah.
Yeah. And we do all the, you know, we're tracking boats all over the place. So we noticed that more boats had kind of stayed in US waters. They hadn't crossed the Med and stayed in the Med to do some work. Generally, that's lots more had stuck around. So there was more option, I suppose, for the charterer.
Yeah,
more boats to choose from.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And I think one of the neat things that happened, and I'm grateful for, because I have a lot of friends in the Caribbean, and that part of the world, as you know, is so dependent on tourism and so dependent on the big white yachts coming in and the cruise ships. And we saw a lot of activity from Russians, Europeans, Asians that normally would have probably chartered in the Med, and they went to places like St. Martin, St. Barts, the Bahamas. And they said, oh my gosh, I'm coming back here again. So we saw a few of those actually rebooking this season in the Caribbean. Of course, many went back to the Med or are going to go back to the Med. But I think it was neat to have that demographic that had never chartered before in the Caribbean to do it and to fall in love with the waters and the people. I'm really hoping that will be a long-term thing for the people of the islands. It'd be great for them.
Well, I think once you've discovered the Caribbean on a charter, I mean, nothing beats it. I mean, it is sensational.
It's totally incredible. It is such a special place. Time slows down, you know, especially those parts of the Caribbean where you have the water that's absolutely perfect and you look around the corner and there's a mountain and a fort. It's just one of those places on earth that you didn't think existed except for in the movies. And it's just really, really special. And they've done a very good job too, I think, of making those places very timeless. And I think, I think there's going to be a growing charter market there for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, traditionally, it's always been the case that some owners were reluctant to, you know, cross the Atlantic, because obviously it's a shorter charter season in the Caribbean. So is it worth the money? Should I just stay here and do some work? That kind of thing. But perhaps given the, you know, abundance of demand, that's going to, you know, spur a few more owners to say, you know, it is worth it to cross the Atlantic and make the boat available for charter over there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's definitely some pros and cons. One of the other cons that, you know, we never in our industry like to talk about hurricanes too much, but that's also one of the things that exist in our part of the world in a certain part of the calendar year that makes it a challenge. But I think there are way more pros than there are cons. And exactly what you said of it does take a little bit more money. There is a little bit more of a risk coming out of the pandemic conversation of I'm willing to spend a little bit more money for that really cool experience, totally new experience for my family. We're just seeing more people that are willing to be more liberal when it comes to spending money and spending time on their boats.
Yeah. And I just wanted to kind of pivot the conversation almost 180, because just because you mentioned technology earlier, and I know you're a man who embraces new technology, because we were talking about NFTs the other day, you and I, and I just like, what is your read on the whole NFT situation and how it affects or how it will affect the yachting industry?
I don't know. I think that there's definitely going to be an impact. I don't know what it is yet. Very much our kids one day might look back on this very conversation and laugh at us as we're trying to stumble our way through a conversation about NFTs. Like we laugh at our parents. And have you ever seen some of those BBC conversations about what the internet's going to be and WW? Yeah, it's hard to define exactly what the impact's going to be, but I think it'll be impactful. We are big believers in using technology again to help the client experience. So for me, I look at NFTs and I think there's probably an opportunity there with documentation and the closing process. I love the collectible part of it, which is less of improving a client experience and more of opening up this world of yachting to a totally different audience. And I love the idea of tying in some of our industry's best designers to sort of the outside world. And then the other part, it's hard not to talk about the metaverse when you talk about NFTs. So digital twinning of boats and introducing the yachting experience in a digital world, whatever the hell that means one day, is going to be something that we're trying to figure out. But we definitely love having these conversations. We want a seat at the table when those conversations are being had. And in the coming weeks or months, we're going to be entering into that space in a little bit more of a significant way. But yeah, all that to say, I don't know, but I know there's something there.
Yeah, I feel much the same way. I start talking about it and realize I really don't know what I'm talking about. So although to be fair, you sound a lot more knowledgeable on the subject than me. I think, but you're right about the collectibles side of it. That seems just like a sideshow. I think the real value in it is, you know, in contract law or, you know, registering boat, or, you know, things that exist in the blockchain forever. Maybe it is a charter contract or it's a bill of sale or something like that. There might be an opportunity.
Yeah, the collectible side though is so interesting to me at least. And a full disclosure, I was one of those nerds as a kid that used to collect baseball cards and football cards. And for me, there was a certain joy to getting my favorite player and putting him in a nice little case and bragging to my friends that I got his rookie card or whatever. So there is that for certain nerdy parts of our population like me. There's a certain joy in that. And I think yachting enthusiasts that have that kind of in them, there might be, you know, however you want to call that, a certain joy to collecting NFTs with some of their favorite designers. So I don't want to totally dismiss that. But in terms of improving client experience for current people in the space, I think it's going to be much more about the documentation, ownership parts of it than it is going to be that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the problem I get I spin out really because the so many of these metaverse platforms and which one's going to win, what's the value of these NFTs, and it's you can really go down a rabbit hole with it and come out the other side none the wiser, really.
And I think the hard part about that too, if we're all honest with each other, and there's some people that aren't, we don't know what space or what part of the metaverse is going to be meaningful or be worth something. And so when you have those conversations, you sometimes get salespeople that sneak in there, or here in the US we call them snake oil sales, where you just feel like you're being sold a bill of goods that don't, and you don't know enough to decipher what's good, or and it's tricky. And I think part of the painful process of these NFT conversations is going to be some people getting taken advantage of, and losing a little bit of money and all that stuff. So it's hard to have the conversation without not talking about that, because there is definitely some warning yellow lights that should be going on at the same time.
Yeah, invest with care,
Yeah, exactly.
as always. I mean, this is your life outside of yachting, although NFTs obviously have an application in yachting. But the digital twinning is quite interesting. So I suppose if you buy a boat, you can have your digital twin in the metaverse, your NFT out there floating around in cyberspace. But the, I mean, do you ever get out on the water yourself? I mean, you, like me, have four children, so spare time. It's successful business. There's not a huge amount of it, but what does a day off look like for Bob Dennison?
So it's really focused on the kids, whether it's showing them how to do a cannonball in the pool, or my kids love, just doing all the stuff kids love, to just go into the playground and things like that. We do have a little boat that we enjoy going out on. I am for sure one of the worst operators of a boat known to man, and I shouldn't be growing up in the industry, but I'm one of those guys that when I pull up to a popular restaurant or marina, my palms start sweating, and I know I'm gonna
Everyone, I'm not, you're not
and
the only
embarrass everybody around me. But so we have a brig, actually. It's my and it's just a fun boat to kind of bang around here on the intercoastal in South Florida, and the kids love it. And again, having an inflatable, I think, is just a really fun way to do it with the kids. By the way, our British friends here at the office always remind me when I take the boat out that ribs were invented or born in Great Britain. Is that correct? Do you have any knowledge on
I
that?
don't, but I'm going to claim it. I'm going to say, yeah, they're absolutely
Yeah.
right.
It seems an odd thing to brag about, but I guess but they are extremely proud of that.
Excellent, excellent. I mean, I mean, everyone. The thing about your name in South Florida, I mean, everyone knows. I mean, everyone. I mean, you turn up to places and people know you, obviously, because you in itself, you're a big character on the scene, but also you carry this name, which has this incredible legacy in that part of the world.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's I'd probably say I'm a lot less known than you just described, but I'll if when my wife hears this, she's gonna roll her eyes, and I'll get a little bit of crap for it. But yeah, I mean, my family did made things way easier for me. My grandparents moved down here in 1948, shortly after started building yachts, Broward Marine, and I'm third generation, so my two uncles, Ken and Skip, and my dad, Kit, really like me, just grew up in it. And as you know, our industry is very, very, very small. And while Fort Lauderdale, of course, we consider ourselves the yachting capital of the world, we're not a big city. So it's a small industry, small town, and it makes things a lot easier when a guy like me can benefit from the legacy that my grandparents and parents and uncles laid out before me. It's sort of like standing on the shoulders of giants. And as I start exploring my kids getting into it, and nieces and nephews, it's really exciting, and we take a lot of pride in it being a family business.
And do you, because it's interesting, because I was talking to Jamie Edmiston the other day and I asked him the same question, because like a bit like you, his name and your names, I mean, there's no getting away from it. They're so tied to the yachting industry. And he left university and he deliberately kind of said, right, I want to spend some time away. I mean, did you also have that same kind of push-pull reaction to it?
Yeah, I don't know what Jamie's experience is like, and I wonder if he would admit this or not. For me, I actually did it very, very much the same thing. I did non-yachting things. I worked for a technology company and an aviation company for a few years. And then I got pulled in, you might call it manipulated in or heavy pressured or this like obligation of what are you doing? You need to get back in here kind of conversation with my family. And again, it's not the hardest sell in the world, right? To get into an industry as great as ours. But yeah, I think I definitely needed a little breathing room after just growing up in it. And I went to university and I, you know, just wanted to explore other things. But yeah, I ended up getting sucked back in about 2-3 years later.
It's actually remarkably similar to, yeah, because James' experience, he left university, when deliberately went and did other things. But again, you know, the lure of the yachting industry, you know, you can't resist it forever, can you?
No. And especially with his name and where he lives, and I guess very much with me too, it's, and you know, I think we're both probably equally as grateful for it too, because there are a lot of people our age that would love to be doing something like this. So yeah, while we were both probably manipulated a little bit, I think we're extremely thankful.
Yeah. Thank you, Bob. That's absolutely brilliant. And I just wanted to ask as well, before I let you go, so how many pairs of colorful chinos do you have in your cupboard at home?
Yeah, so I am the owner, and this is going to be very disappointing for you to hear, but I will admit it. I only have in my closet, if you were to walk into it, or what you would call a cupboard, I have 4 pairs of pants. And I think people think I'm way more stylish than I am because I have the courage or the just the stupidity to wear really bright colored pants every day. And it looks like I have a big wardrobe, but it's just 4. And it works. But the trick to it, by the way, Stuart, in case you wanted to go down that journey with me, is you have to have a solid shirt or blazer. That's the limiting factor, colorful pants. Yeah. You can't wear plaid shirt or something that's going to draw attention away. So you need to be conservative up top and loud at the bottom.
Okay, so with the bright yellow chinos, you'd pair just a blue or yeah. Or a solid brown blazer.
That's it. I have 1 brown blazer and 1 blue blazer, and that's it. And I wear them interchangeably. And yeah, it works. And the nice thing about that, by the way, in case you're wondering, is it takes me about 45 seconds to get ready in the morning because it all kind of goes together. I have very few options. And that hassle of my life has just been eliminated.
Less hassle, the better. I'm only mildly disappointed because I always see you with very colorful chinos on. And I imagined your closet at home is just a rainbow.
Oh, it's so depressing. Yeah. So my wife and I share a closet. She occupies about 85% of the real estate in our closet. And my section is very small, but very bright.
Yeah. I can sympathize. But I also share some closet space with my wife, and I'm relegated to a small corner of it. Hers is mostly shoes, it must be said.
Oh, good. I'm glad we're getting into that. I will tell you for me as well. So this is going to be the perfect opportunity to invite both of our wives to listen to this episode.
I'm not sure my wife has ever listened to a boat briefing podcast, but maybe this could be the one. We'll see.
Yeah.
Bob, so fun talking to you. Thank you so much. I mean, just fantastic congratulations on your amazing couple of years of success. Obviously, you know, generated through many years of extremely hard work, and long may it continue.
Thank you very, very much. Big deal for me to be talking to you, and Boat International has been awesome partners of ours, and just so grateful for the relationship. So thank you.
Brilliant. Cheers, Bob.
Thank you for listening to this week's Big Boat interview, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to tune in on Friday to our Boat Briefing podcast to hear all the news and views from the world of super yachting. In the meantime, don't forget to like and subscribe, and I hope you have a fantastic week.